Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in American Studies. I'm your host, Ryan Shelton, and today we're joined by Professor Daniel T. Rogers, the Henry Charles Lee Professor of History Emeritus at Princeton University, and author of the new book, As a City on a Hill, The Story of America's Most Famous Lay Sermon, published in 2018 by Princeton University Press. This charming book tells an engaging history of John Winthrop's now famous sermon, A Model of Christian Charity, which now stands in popular political discourse as a foundational text of American politics after 3.5 centuries of virtual neglect. It's a twisting and surprising tale, and I'm very excited to have Professor Rogers here to tell us more about it. Thanks for joining us, Dan, and welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, before we get into the details of the book, Dan, we'd like for you to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself. You've had a long and distinguished career of teaching and writing. Your books consistently won awards, including the prestigious Bancroft Prize for your 2011 book, The Age of Fracture. Tell us a little bit about your education and career, especially as it led you to write this newest book, As a City on a Hill.
Well, the career was a complicated one, Ryan, and I won't go into all of that. I didn't imagine myself becoming an historian, but I came of age, went to college in the 1960s when if you wanted to know what was going on in the world, what mattered was what people were arguing about. There was an enormous fertility of ideas in those years, and there still is. And it threw me into the history of ideas, the history of beliefs, the history of arguments, the history of discourse, as we call it, maybe more neutrally. There are others who were drawn to the power of ideas, who wanted to pin down an idea in its pure form or to think about it as a philosophy. Philosopher might think about it, but I was not interested in that nearly so much as I was interested in the mutability of ideas, the fact that ideas changed so often and yet kept their power throughout the events around them to shape people's imaginations, to shape their actions, to shape their the very frame in which they were living. And so I've written about all kinds of ideas over time, always in a context of change. The first one was a book called The Work Ethic in Industrial America, about how persons in the United States, but also to some extent in England, took ideas about the moral value of hard work and tried to reassess them at the time when machinery and industrialization had changed so much about work. What did they change? What did they stick to, even when the fit became more and more tenuous? And then I got interested in political ideas, wrote a book called Contested Truths, about the ways in which Americans have argued about politics since the 18th century. All the time, I knew that doing only American history, only American studies, was a distortion of the real ways in which history operates. Americans who talked about the value of work read Samuel Smiles as often as they read Horatio Alger. They were deeply infected by the work of Thomas Carlyle. They lived in a transatlantic world. And so I took one of the set pieces of American history, the progressive years, and tried to rewrite that history in a international, transnational framework, just at the moment when transnational studies were getting underway. It was an exciting piece of work to try to think about what had always been a American-centered problem, the progressive years of progressive reform in the context of France, Germany, England, as well as the United States. Then I got interested in the changes in ideas all across the board, from economic ideas to political ideas, in the period since the 1970s, in a book called Age of Fracture. That's the book that won the Bancroft Prize. And I sometimes tease it was won the Bancroft Prize because of its title. Fracture is the word of our time, but it also, I think, was a real attempt to try to think about how ideas change as radically as they have since the 1970s, and how new ideas of the more isolated, free to choose individual came into currency in so many, many different areas. And then I did the book we're going to talk about, because I thought I'd never looked at a single text before. I'd always done these landscape studies. What would it be like to think about the transformations of a single text and a single idea? And so that brought me to City on a Hill.
Your book very artfully lays out the story of Winthrop's model in really kind of three acts. The first part attends to the production of the text itself and the immediate context that Winthrop was writing into. Right from the outset, you make a striking observation that America's most famous lay sermon might not technically have maybe even been a sermon at all, at least certainly not by 17th century standards. What was the origin of Winthrop's model, to the best we can know?
Let me back up just one sec to talk about that, because I began actually with the myth that's around the model of Christian charity, the text, and the myth that's around the phrase that Americans remember most vividly from it when they remember anything now, which is that we shall be as a city on a hill, because the received story does have it as a sermon given by John Winthrop, the governor of the company that was going to settle in Massachusetts, the Puritan-backed settlement that wasn't the beginning of U.S. history, of course, but was one of the early attempts to try to figure out what the English were going to do in their invasion of the North American continent. And in that version that was in every textbook at the time that I started thinking about this text, the governor, John Winthrop, had been in the middle of a sea voyage. He had come to either just off the shores of England, or perhaps in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, or maybe in the harbor of Boston. And he gathered folks together and said, "This is who we are. We are a people in covenant with God to make a new and better society, and the world will notice, and we will be as a city upon the hill with the eyes of all people upon us." So that's where I started, and so it made it all the more startling that so much of that is wrong. It's clear that Winthrop had been thinking about the ideas that went into the City on the Hill text long before he got to the Atlantic Ocean. It's not a mid-Atlantic discourse at all. And as you say, it's probably not a sermon at all. He had been in the middle of a meeting of investors in the New England settlement. And there was a fierce, fierce argument about debts, about repayments of debts, about what the investors should do when their money was going sour in an investment that was costing more and more and seemed to be still not close to fruition. And he pleaded with them to renew their investments, even if they were going to lose, using phrases out of the Bible to reiterate the ways in which debts must be forgiven when the greater glory of God was in the way of being executed. You had to lay aside all market issues. You had to lay aside profit and loss, and do what was required. You must practice charity. And that's the core of the model of Christian charity. It's a sermon about, or I shouldn't say a sermon, it began as a speech. It was probably turned into either a sermon on sometime in the process of getting either onto the ships or perhaps, though I doubt it, later on. And it was then that the City on the Hill phrase was added. But it begins as a plea to investors, and it begins as a discourse about love, about mutuality, about the dependency of everybody in that colony upon each other, even when profit and loss should dictate otherwise.
You know, the notion of being a chosen people often attends closely to the history of this text. You make the observation that in the original context, this notion of a covenanted people might not have had altogether triumphant overtones. So how did Winthrop conceive of the Massachusetts settlers' relationship to God? And was this particularly exceptional in 1630s across Atlantic Christendom?
It wasn't exceptional at all, and that was behind your question, Ryan, and should be behind all our listeners' first responses. How unusual was it to imagine one's city, one's society, one's settlement, one's nation in covenant with God? And the answer is, in Protestant Europe, that idea was everywhere. The English had been insistent, even before the Puritan Revolution, that they were a chosen people of God. The Calvinists in Holland and in the Low Countries of Germany were equally insistent that they were a chosen people of God. Calvin in Geneva used covenant theology. It was their way of understanding who they were in the biblical text. They were like the people of Israel, and it wasn't unusual at all. He picked it right out of the air, and he didn't do anything terribly special or terribly American with it, because always the notion of being in the footsteps of Israel was a double-edged place to be in historical time. After all, God in the Old Testament chooses the people of Israel to be his, but he also, in that very act, sets up their disobedience and what will happen if they disobey. If they were perfect people, it would all be easy. But of course, no people are perfect. And so being a chosen people means that you're always in terror, a potential terror of backsliding, failing to live up to your promise, being less than you hope to be, not exercising charity, as Winthrop said, as fully and as deeply and wholeheartedly as you should. That double side comes through in Winthrop's own phrase, City on a Hill, where he talks about Massachusetts being a city on the hill, just like many of the Puritan towns in England would call themselves cities upon a hill. But it was a city on a hill in two senses. It was going to radiate society better than other societies, a society that was trying to live in covenant with God. But it was also going to be exposed to the scrutiny of everyone. It was going to be visible. It was going to be naked on the kind of mountaintop of its own aspirations, so that if it failed, its failure was going to be spectacular. And for Winthrop, City on a Hill, chosen people, always had this double edge of confidence, enormous confidence, and the enormous sense of the fragility of what one was undertaking.
We'll discuss a little later how Winthrop's sermon was revived in the midst of a great economic struggle during the late 20th century Cold War tensions. But you notice that some of those same economic overtones, and you've touched on this a little bit already, permeate the creation of the document itself. At least it was in Winthrop's mind as he was conceiving it before the voyage, but perhaps without exactly the same kind of market capitalism with which it's been more recently associated. What were some of the important values around this model of Christian charity that Winthrop advocated?
Well, one of the chestnut questions that everybody in our listener reach will know that historians have asked, and American studies folks have asked about American history for a very long time, was how deeply capitalist was the founding of the British settlements in the new continent. Was American capitalist from the beginning? Was it a society, a market society? Was it a society that valued economic ambition? And the answer, of course, is very complicated, because there is no uniformity among the first British settlements in North America. The slave and wealth-seeking societies of Virginia and the South were quite different from what Winthrop was trying to help establish in Boston, and they were very different from what the Quakers would do in Pennsylvania later on. But the interesting thing about Massachusetts is that it managed to combine a market society, a capitalist society, which the forms of a modern corporation were all there. The drive for returns on investment was all there. It managed to combine that with doubts, with some sense that market capitalism alone, the market alone, was not sufficient. And so I was fascinated with the ways in which not only did the early Massachusetts authorities try every sporadically, but came back over and over again to the question about whether prices should be allowed to be simply run free. When there were shortages, should merchants be able to charge as much as they wanted? When there were shortages of labor, should laborers be able to charge as much as they wanted? And I was also fascinated with the way in which they brought to into this beginnings of American settlement a concern with the poor, Winthrop's notion of charity, notion of love across different social classes, is actually one of the most profound and eloquent statements. The Massachusetts Puritans didn't really like the poor. They in many ways begrudged the taxes they paid for the poor. They disciplined the poor. They made sure that the poor were kept under control, but nevertheless, they supported them. And so I was fascinated with the stories of some of those who struck me as coming right straight out of Winthrop's text, ne'er-do-wells, shiftless folks they would have been called, who drank too much, or who had too many children, which was a problem for the authorities. They were nonetheless supported by the early Massachusetts authorities because they were part of the community, because they had a claim on the common weal that Winthrop tried to enunciate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. Well, I'd like to move now to the second section of your book. For most of the 18th and 19th century, Winthrop and his model were largely forgotten. You discussed this growing need for foundational documents to provide a national mythology, but the Puritans and John Winthrop, they sure didn't seem to fill much of a role in the nation's history during that time. What were some of the earlier sources of textual foundations? And how did the New England Puritans eventually jockey for that position in the American pantheon?
The Puritans certainly were not in the early years of the 18th century thought of as the founders of the nation. They were an isolated, very in time, wealthy, important sub-colony amidst the other colonies. And when the first histories of the United States began to be written, or the first celebrations of the United States began to be made, those celebrations began with the founding documents of the Revolution. They began with for the Jeffersonians with the Declaration of Independence, though the Declaration of Independence was much, much more disputed at its time than the myths have it. They began with the Constitution, though again, the Constitution was highly disputed at its own time. They began with the political documents of the founding of the U.S. nation. And the Puritans were not in the picture at all for many reasons. Early New England was by no means a democracy. Even though the governors were elected, only church members could vote in colony-wide elections. There was enormously strict discipline that was that kept that population under control. Religious toleration only came by the imposition from the English authorities, not from the Puritans themselves. And so there was a lot, not a lot in Massachusetts at the beginning to celebrate. What Massachusetts was important for was that the active resistance to British rule began in Boston. Boston was a very unruly place by the end of the 18th century, but it began with not church figures nearly so much as sailors and other ambitious lay folk like John Adams and Sam Adams. But in the 19th century, New Englanders, out of regional pride, began not only to begin to write their own history in a much more laudatory way than had been written before, but they began to argue that they were the beginnings of American history. They even got this young visitor, Alexis de Tocqueville, to agree with them. He stayed in Boston in the early parts of his visit to the United States. He soaked up everything that he was told there, and he relayed some of it. The beginnings of American society must lie in the Puritan, with the Puritan settlement. But nobody much believed them for a long, long while, despite their importance in the history writing in the early years. And above all, they didn't think that the Puritans, particularly Winthrop's generation of Puritans, were the ancestors of the nation. As I say, they were not democratic enough. They were too elitist. They were too bound in their own particular religious convictions and religious belief. And so you can look through textbooks in the 18th century, early textbooks in the 18th century, the textbooks all the way through the 19th century, the textbooks in the first part of the 20th century, and you simply will not find the model of Christian charity or the city on the hill phrase used in those textbooks at all. Even by figures like Woodrow Wilson, whom we think must have absorbed this notion of the importance in divine history of the United States, he didn't know the text. He wasn't interested in the text.
I found one of the most interesting chapters in this portion of the book where Winthrop and his model are kind of underground, still forgotten, was your chapter on the African Republic of Liberia. While not directly appealing to Winthrop's model, you note a reprise of this city on a hill rhetoric, and you also note some striking parallels between the way the phrase was used then with Winthrop's own context. What does 17th century Boston have in common with 19th century Monrovia?
Let me back up just one step there. It was one of the most fascinating things I found, that if you're going to look for city on the hill rhetoric, and that phrase in and of itself applied to a nation, not applied to a church or a small group of people, but if you're going to apply it to a nation, it was the founders of Liberia who were most eager to take it up and who used it most intensively. But the point I want to back up to make is that all nations that emerged from the end of the 18th century on, the new kind of national power, the new kind of country which claimed to have a special place in the allegiance and the hearts and the souls of its people, they all talked about themselves in one way or another as being special. They all talked about themselves in one way or another as being examples to the rest of the world. They all talked about themselves in one way or another as having a special relation with history or with God or with destiny. And so phrases like the city on a hill were around. The point that was a surprise, and that I want to emphasize, is that they didn't need Winthrop to talk about these sorts of things. And the settlers of Liberia didn't know Winthrop's text and didn't use Winthrop's text. But they knew the core point that Winthrop had enunciated in that text when he got to the City on a Hill section. They knew that founding what was going to be the first Black-led republic on the continent of Africa was going to be a task of enormous controversy around the world. They knew it was an experiment in trying to prove what people of color could do as full citizens, as founders of nations. And so they talked about themselves as being an example, a radiant example, a city on the hill to other on the African continent, that they too could find their way out of colonial fetters, find their way into nationhood, but also as if they were under the eyes of a very, very skeptical world, that they were under scrutiny all the time as others waited for their failure. And so in that sense, they did recapitulate some of what was in Winthrop's mind. They were going to make a society unlike a society that had existed before, and they were going to be watched every single moment by those who were waiting for its failure.
As we move into the final part of your book, which you call Icon, we see a forgotten text turn into a rhetorical centerpiece of American politics. You pick up the story with the commissioning of a statue in Boston. What caused this new wave of interest in New England Puritans in the early part of the 20th century, both in public and also in the academy?
Well, the first part of it has to do with the continuing regional boosterism of the New Englanders. It was during the course of a celebration of the 300th year of Boston's settlement that the statue that has the text, the famous part of the Mount City of the Hill text on it was erected. But that was still a very local affair. It's also important to say that the first president who used the city on a hill phrase, John Kennedy, was still talking in local terms. He didn't refer to the United States as the city upon the hill. He referred to the legislature of the state of Massachusetts as needing to think about itself as more closely under the scrutiny of those who were deeply, deeply concerned with its corruptions. And get its act together as if it were a city on the hill. But that's an aside. The precipitating event was the Cold War. Cold War did two things to American society, to talk really, really in simplified terms. One is it consolidated the nation around its sense of opposition to this new superpower, its own realization of its superpower status itself. Which meant that more and more persons began to study what they called American studies, trying to think about the nature of American society as a whole, rather than in regional terms or rather than in terms of diverse classes, as Charles Beard had sketched the core history of the United States, or rather than in terms of the frontier, as Frederick Jackson Turner had argued. They began to try to find what unified Americans. And they also were deeply concerned that there was not quite enough to unify Americans. And so they began to look for texts, they began to look for ideas. The phrase American idea, the American idea, comes out of the Cold War because it was clear that the Soviet Union was broadcasting around the world a sense of what its idea was, what its mission in the world was, what its core intention was. What was America besides this jumble of people and its complicated history and a civil war that wasn't all that far in the past? And so it was in the context of looking for American studies, for the American core, and it, above all, a belief that was at the American core, that the first persons stumbled onto Winthrop's forgotten text. Perry Miller, whom many of your listeners will know by reputation, was one of the first to do so. But then Dan Boorstin joined in that. Slowly by the late 50s and early 60s, you begin to see references to Winthrop. And you begin to see references to Winthrop much less hostile than those that had been in play before. One of my own teachers, a wonderful teacher and extraordinary historian named Edmund S. Morgan, wrote a book on Winthrop in the 1960s. As an example of a man who, in a dangerous world, used power with discretion and wisdom. Not perfectly, but used power with discretion. Ed was not a conventional cold warrior, but that was a parable for the Cold War, for what he hoped that those now in authority in the United States would do with the with the authority that they had and the dangers of the world in which they lived. So it's in this context that that Winthrop began to emerge, that Puritans themselves began to emerge as giving a still deeper foundation to this thing called America than the Declaration of Independence, than the Constitution, to make a civilization out of America, where one could might have said there was no civilization to begin with, but a group of competing and sometimes cooperating civilizations.
Well, the real catapult of Winthrop sitting on a hill, you mentioned, is in the political speeches of Ronald Reagan, coming right out of this period that you've been describing. What about Winthrop's vision first attracted the aspiring president, and how did his use of the sermon develop from his early political rise and through to the end of his political career?
Reagan is the one who makes the city on a hill phrase, the iconic phrase in American politics that was going to last all the way to the beginning of the Donald Trump presidency. It became a phrase that was indelibly associated with him, but also compulsory for all political figures and compulsory for textbook writers and compulsory for all those who made anthologies of American literature and American studies. We don't know exactly where Reagan got the phrase, though we actually know that he got it himself. He wrote the core lines about the city on the hill down in a note card. He used to keep note cards, 3x5 note cards in his suit jacket pocket. And when he was giving extemporaneous speeches, which he did all the way through the 1950s, he would pull those note cards out and look for a quotation that seemed apt to the point. And there it is in his own handwriting. You can still find the thing in the Reagan National Library in California. But for him, what the phrase meant was that in the midst of turmoil, in the midst of struggle, in the midst of a struggle that for him by now was not only international struggle with the Cold War, but a struggle at home against the student radicals in California, against whom he took a very hard and very prominent stand, there were still a promise, a hope that Americans, and a destiny, that Americans ultimately would be a city upon the hill to themselves and to the world. And he took that into the White House. The striking thing about what happens when it goes into the White House is that Winthrop's sense of struggle, Winthrop's sense that the city upon the hill was fragile, his speechwriters who began to get a hold of the phrase for the first time were not quite so sure that this was what Americans wanted to hear. And so they began to bathe the city on a hill, if I can put it that way, in more light, more hope, more optimism. They made it simpler. And they also made it very, very powerful. That Reagan did was to take Winthrop's phrase with all its anxiety and erase the anxiety and give us instead, we are a radiant city, a city of lights, a city of continuous lights, the hope and beacon to all the world, unique, exceptional, and I'm proud. And that was by the end of the closing years of the Cold War. We can't say the Cold War was over during Reagan's term, but as it became clear that the Soviet Union's challenge was not going to be as dangerous to American place in the world as it seemed earlier, that cheerleading side of Reagan was what Americans wanted to hear. And he somehow transformed this complicated man of both hopes and pessimism into a cheerleader for America.
That's fascinating. So since Reagan, you observe that Winthrop's model has been part of nearly every major politician's rhetoric, with the noteworthy exception of Donald Trump, which at the time that we're recording this is in its last few weeks, perhaps last few days, if some are correct. I have to add that I wish I'd read your book prior to the 2020 election cycle, because I might have been paying closer attention to whether Winthrop's phrase has been picked up again. I'm curious if you noticed any reprisals in recent months, but more importantly, where do you think the current role of Winthrop's idea is in American life? Do you think Winthrop would recognize much, if anything, of his own thoughts in its current iteration?
Well, the answer to the last part is I don't think Winthrop would recognize much at all. He wanted a godly society, and he would have looked at around the world, and he would not have found one to his liking. And there's this curious way in which we deal with the past, in which we want to yank these figures from the past. We want to yank Thomas Jefferson suddenly into 2021, say, well, Tom, what would you have thought of what's going on? And these are silly exercises that historians ought to get over. They would have found themselves bewildered because the whole structure of society, the structure of the economy, the structure of thought changes so much. But we have this fairly strong desire to imagine that there's a straight line between a nation's past and its present. And so we're always inventing a linear history in which somehow Winthrop, Jefferson, Lincoln, Wilson, Reagan all lead unbrokenly to the present. Each one would have been bewildered by what had happened before. But do people still use the phrase? James Comey used the phrase after he'd been fired as FBI director by Donald Trump. I'm sure that that we will hear it from Joe Biden, because he'll pick it up as the counterpoint to the other side that Donald Trump made so vivid, so volatile, so terrifying in many, many ways. Because what Donald Trump picked up was the sense that for many Americans, they don't imagine they live in a city on the hill. They don't imagine they live in a society organized as it should be. They're angry. We saw that so vividly in the last week. They live in a kind of continuous anger. Some of them are very faithful churchgoers, and so they also live with hope, sometimes eschatological hope, that a new world is around the corner, certainly with a sense of somehow God will make all of this right. But in the meantime, they live with a sense of displacement in their own society and anger at their own society. And so by shoving over the idea of the city on the hill, which I don't think Trump ever knew about the phrase, and if it had been proposed to him, he would have rejected. He talked about the United States as a disaster over and over again. It was, everything was wrong. It was surrounded by enemies. It needed to be made great again. But at the moment, it was a dumpster fire, as one of the commentators put it. He ran with that sort of oppositional idea to the city on the hill as far as anybody has ever done, stoked more anger than anybody had ever done. And I think that Joe Biden is going to come back and say, in fact, these things are not as they should be, but this is a nation that still has things to be proud of in the world. And it ought to get on with that and cool the emotional angers that Trump made his calling card. So if I were a betting person, Ryan, I would bet we hear more about the city on the hill. But would it be Winthrop City on the Hill? No, it hasn't been for centuries.
Well, Dan, it's been such an honor to talk with you about this wonderful book, As a City on a Hill. Before we say goodbye, I wonder if you'd like to share with us a little bit about what you're currently working on.
Well, it's hard to know exactly how this is going to shape up, Ryan, and I'm always hesitant to talk about what I'm working on when it's still so unclear in my mind. There are people, historians, really wonderful historians who know exactly what they're interested in and exactly what they're going to find. And I must say, this book that we've just been talking about, like all of them, it began kind of in the middle. It began with a whole set of questions. Who knew where it was going to go until it went? And that's one of the joys and excitement for me, of thinking about history. But what I'm thinking about now is actually thinking about the writing of American history. This huge debate in American society now, in American political society now, about whether textbooks and accounts of American history should be celebratory, should they be critical, should they talk about a unitary people, should they talk about a diverse and contending groups of Americans. It's a ferocious political debate, which is going nowhere at that level. But I want to try to see if there's ways of sketching out the different formulas for writing a history of the nation. Really complicated question. What is a nation? Does it have a unitary history? How do you write about it? How do you put the pieces together in a way that's honest, that's full, that helps us understand the societies we live in? And so that's what I'm thinking about, whether this be a short book, whether it would be a long essay. I don't know, but I'm thinking about history itself.
That sounds like important and timely work, and I can't wait to learn from you more as that project develops. Well, once again, we've been speaking with Professor Daniel T. Rogers about his book, As a City on a Hill, The Story of America's Most Famous Lay Sermon, published in 2018 by Princeton University Press, just made available in paperback last fall. I hope you give it a read. We've only just scratched the surface, and there are nuggets in every chapter. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for listening to the New Books Network. Visit our website at newbooksnetwork.com for more great interviews. There you can find a link to purchase all the books on our show from bookshop.org, where part of the proceeds will go to support local booksellers. If you enjoyed the interview, share it with your friends, leave a review, or subscribe on your favorite podcast app. It's been great to be with you, and I hope you have a great day.